Mr. James, Reel 17. Right, Mr. James, we're still talking about Winchelsea, and we've talked a little bit about the officers and the contrast in styles between Major Balance and Major Whalen. Could you talk a little bit about the billet routine for the enlisted men? I mean, obviously you were your colour sergeant, and how that worked. From a day-to-day basis.
In Winchelsea?
Yeah.
Yes, well, in Winchelsea, as far as I was concerned, I had a lot of returns to submit at that particular time to the quartermaster, to Captain Ponder, who was president of the Regiment Institutes, general sort of necessary returns made to the academy quarters as well. But it was mainly admin for me. Kit inspections. The beautiful big houses there with enormous lawns were a boom, really, because and the weather was good as well in the summer of 1942. So we used to have kit inspections on the lawns, and were aware of the fact that we weren't very far off going really overseas as well. Although we didn't know much about what was happening at the end of 1942 when Operation Torch happened in Tunisia. But it was kit inspections, it was training, and C Company trained and the Major Balance who came from Rye. At the time, in 1942, Major Balance was, in the beginning of 1942, the company commander of a corps company. In Rye, and his Commissar Major Gates, who was an ex-Bedsonhurst chap and a weird little cockney, but a very smart chap, a good soldier, of course, immaculately turned out, you know, always with the crease in his trousers. He wasn't a very tall chap, he was short, and he tried his very best. He was a regular soldier, of course, but he used to waddle, and he was a character, really, and I liked him. I got on very well with him, but he was a real cockney. Not an educated man, had his own sort of way of talking, and it's thought that he could write as well and be humorous. He was very humorous, actually, but he's a character I can't forget.
Can you remember any specific incidents of his humour?
Well, I didn't soldier with him in the same company, but I was aware of him. But when we were overseas together, it was much later. Especially after Tunisia, when we were at Breda, I accompanied him on one or two trips into Algeria.
We'll talk about that later. In terms of these kit inspections, what were you inspecting and how would it work?
We were inspecting, I had my list, of course, of the shoes, and we were very keen to ensure that any losses were made up. And it was of prime importance for the soldier to have a full kit when we would probably be calling overseas a short notice. And so we had frequent kit inspections in Winchelsea. The staffs were well known in those days to because clothing was short and granddad couldn't buy any pants for the winter. And I'm quite certain that lots of the blokes took their heavy, thick underwear home and gave it to granddad. So they had to have for the winter anyway all their winter woolies, and so the main purpose of the exercise was to catch those people out who were short of these things, and they paid for them. And they were quite odd chaps who were deficient.
Were there any persistent offenders? Any men that spring to mind that were always getting into trouble with you?
Well. Not really. We weren't a bad crowd. They knew as well that they were going to be caught out. They were a bit shocked when they were caught out. But they weren't charged or anything. They weren't put on the charge. 252, that was the army disciplinary form. We weren't getting in trouble for offences. But they were certainly made up with any deficiencies, and they were charged while they took their pocket.
When you were doing these kit inspections, who else would be with you on it? I mean, would you have like a...
There was a sergeant appointed daily in all companies as the company order sergeant for the day, and he'd been a runner, he'd been doing duties of various duties running about, and he would also attend the mess hall, and he would be under George Broadhead. In my case, he was a company sergeant, so the company order sergeant as well appeared on Steele's order, so he would sort of get the chaps in trouble at the company commander's office for the CEO's orders and things like that. And he'd also deal with all sorts of administrative matters and attend lunches, parade as well, when they were having dinner.
And the various administrative matters, what would they be? Could you just remember some of the things that he'd have to do?
Well, arose, he was more or less an assistant to the company manager and to the supervisor, really. And if anything had to be done, and you sort of were anchored at your desk, you'd say, oh, well, call the old sergeant, and we'll let him do this. And give him the small tasks that he would carry out. And even to the extent sometimes of going along and collecting the rations sometimes. The old sergeant was a general dog's body when he was on duty for that day.
And would the orderly sergeant, would he be, would that be a rota for the platoon sergeant?
Was that platoon sergeant?
So that would be Charlie Bray, Sergeant King.
Yeah, it would all be a turn in due course, and they'd be orderly sergeant for the day, and they were sort of given those duties for the day.
What about the men's quarters? You've talked a little bit about the company office and where you were.
Yes.
Where were the men billeted?
Well, the company office, of course, was in this particular house, where it was shared by both C and D companies, and they were administrative officers only. The men were billeted by platoons in the various empty houses in the village. D Company occupied an enormous, large corner house right opposite the church and nearly opposite the company offices, actually. And C Company were higher up near the pump and to the left. Of course, the church dominated the village, but all these empty houses faced the church up and across, and these houses were all occupied by the troops. Various platoons.
So, how many men would be in that? Would you have the entire D Company would be in that one house?
The entire D Company, wouldn't be in one. The house would be large enough. It'd probably be spread between two or even three houses, as our members said, right? So that the accommodation was there. There was a bit of population and left them all empty. And we looked after the village, and we didn't abuse the village, so we kept everything in order and clean as well.
So would the billets be inspected? Would there be a routine for
absolutely
that?
Absolutely every day.
And who would do that?
The billets, or the sergeant, with the order officer. There was an officer also nominated by the company commander every day for officer's duties. And they'd be going to the dining hall in midday and all that sort of thing. And the only officer of the day would be on orders made out the night before for tomorrow. And so they'd all know what their duties would be.
Yeah. In terms of the NCOs that you were with and that you were working with at this time, did you form any opinions on what made a good NCO and what made a bad NCO?
Well, I tell you what, they were all good NCOs. They had to be, because those who had three stripes, and even the non-sergeants, they were given those three stripes because of their proficiency and bearing and knowledge and leadership. They weren't sergeants, lucky to be sergeants with three stripes. They were sergeants because they deserved it. And they strove to keep the stripes. They were all good, but the other part, the company commander as well. There was the hierarchy. There were the sergeants. They valued their positions. They had lance sergeants, and they had corporals. So they would delegate the corporals, and the corporals had lance corporals, and they would delegate to the lance corporals. And this was the way of the army.
Other veterans have talked about how sometimes the worst NCO to deal with would be the Lance Corporal, because he was always pushing for his second strike. Does that? Yeah,
absolutely.
Do you have any?
You come to think of it now, who's Lance Corporal? You know, he's not very far. I mean, he was from being a private. Now, he, if he was given a chance, because of his zeal and his willingness and his enthusiasm, and his, he was watched by all the NCOs and all those. Everybody wanted to look after the leaders. And if there was a smart private soldier who was given the stick of the guards, the sentries, duties, and very efficient, but he was never in trouble and all those things, you say, well, he's a good Lance Corporal. Well, you make him up, sometimes you say, I don't want it, sir. Why didn't you want it? This is the army. You're a fool to refuse it. It's the first step up the ladder. You know, there's a field marshal's baton and everybody's knapsack. Why don't you want it? I don't want to be my friends, sir. I value my friends. I don't want to be giving them orders. I would prefer to be a private soldier. Perhaps I wouldn't have the leadership at the moment. I said, on the other hand, you might well prove yourself a VC winner. You don't know. You shouldn't refuse. You should. Yes, sir, well, I've been with my friends for so long now that I wouldn't, I'd lose them if I had my strength. I wouldn't want it. But you look at the other one and you say, yes, thank you very much, sir. Yes, I'm keen, yes. You know, the path to success is strewn with broken friendships. That's what they say.
Now, in terms of a junior NCO like a Lance Corporal, would the way to get noticed, would that be to put a man on a charge or to be a bit of a stickler?
Well, some of them got officials when they were given one of the power. But on the other hand, they were judged and they were considered very, very closely by their superiors whether they were justified in doing this and whether they were sort of power drunk suddenly. And there were one or two of these young chaps who eventually got very power drunk, especially in the ITCs, in the barracks, especially pre-war soldiers. But we had a temper justice. We had to decide, I wonder, you know, he's got his chap in charge. We'll listen to the case, but we'll also bear in mind, probably, we've got to decide whether he's prejudiced or whether he's fair.
So what kind of trouble would get a man on a charge? I mean, what were the common misdemeanors at this stage?
Disobeying orders, maybe told to be on parade at a certain time and he was late. I had to shave that morning. You had to shave every morning in the army. And some chaps could get away with it. Chipped like eggshells. But others would grow quite a good beard. And if they hadn't shaved and if they hadn't polished their shoes, it was, you know, a turnout, really, mainly. Small offences, perhaps smoking on parade or not putting his cigarettes out quick enough or not getting up at a rally in the mornings or whatever. But small things, all the small things counted in the army, and the small orders had to be obeyed. If they weren't, well, they had to be cracked down upon. If they had enough corps, they didn't do it. The full corps would notice if he wasn't doing his job as a he was a junior policeman, after all, if you work it out, you know. The military law, you know, everybody's subject to military law on what they're doing, they didn't work for military law. They've got to ensure that soldiers have got to comply, and that's it.
And what would be the punishments, the range of punishments, the smallest punishment to the highest punishment?
That's 252 would be the charge sheet, you see, and there's also, as well, the record sheet. And kept by the Capital Major in the company office. And A typical punishment would be 3 days CB. That's the smallest. 3 days CB.
And what's CB?
For 3 days. And then if it is a little bit more serious, 7 days CB. And things like that. And infectious mainly. And fatigues. You know, peeling spots in the cookhouse. Extra carrying of coal and things like that, and not good at jobs, maybe, you know, but washing floors sometimes.
And if it was a more serious offence, how would it step up from that?
Well, of course, a more serious offence. I mean, like, confined barracks was considered serious enough, like that. A more serious offence, well, would be tried by the commanding officer, the company commander. Would say, I have got the power to deal with this. This is a serious crime. You've got to go and see his orders, commanding officer's orders. And that was daily. And those people who paid for the cattle were in deep trouble. Beyond the powers of the company commander, who thought it was too serious for him to deal with.
Now, did you have your own kind of team of NCOs? Who were below you? Was it a corporal or a lance corporal? You know,
well,
your staff?
No. The captain's our major was responsible for discipline and for all NCOs in the company. The CQMS, of course. And yes, the crowd of his staff to put the sergeants in line. You know what I mean? It was all the hierarchy, so that. But the CQMS was mainly confined to duties of officer, and discipline matters were left to the company sergeant major. But the CQMS certainly had powers to put anybody on a charge and charge, and, you know, and turn anybody off.
Did you ever have to do that?
Oh, frequently.
Can you remember any examples of?
Yeah, let me say, you know, particularly, I mean, the sergeants, the platoon sergeants, you said, we answered them to me, and I'd ask their names sometimes, you know, to make sure that things are in order, and if there's any loss of equipment, especially, they certainly had to report to me.
So if a man in one of the D Company platoons had lost his underclothing or something, and the sergeant would be.
He would inform me. And if any equipment was damaged, I mean, there were compasses issued sometimes, there were whistles issued, you know, everybody, every sergeant had a whistle, checking his lanyard. It's a police whistle, actually, I think of mine, it's in the hall. At this very minute, funny enough, and all sorts of little bits of equipment, and if they were missing or damaged, I'd have to be informed.
Was there any examples during this period of what we would call victimisation of NCOs coming down hard on a man just because they didn't like him, or did any examples of that?
We were always told that was very, very serious. It wasn't just allowed in the army. It wasn't allowed in the army, really. Prejudices weren't allowed in the army. But we, of course, there were people who were big bosses, you know, who really were prejudiced and they were stickers and had it in their hand. Oh, it wasn't unknown. But that had to be jumped on. And it was, you know, the army is supposed to be a place where a soldier could do his soldiering without fear of being victimized. And one had to be careful about that. I'm quite certain that some of the sergeants, you know, were probably not quite in order. They'd keep it disciplined in the correct manner. If it was troubled, they would be in themselves, or whoever was reported it.
Now, at this stage, it's a Durham battalion, but there's still, you know, a large number of Bezenart NCOs.
Yes.
Had the tensions that we've talked about earlier, had they subsided now? Or had people gelled as a battalion?
Well, or was there still myself, although I decided that my better half cap badge was a thing of the past, and I was now a 100% DNI man. You know, the clock couldn't be turned backwards. I was used to the battalion, and I liked the regiment. But they were others who would never forget the Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire regiment. And there was always, you know, with the very senior ones especially, this feeling that they didn't belong to the DNI. And a little bit of resentment felt as well. I noticed that they weren't very close companions to people like Arthur Pearson and the other DNI chaps. If they went out, they stuck together. They were Bedfords with Bedfords. I noticed the senior ranks. I noticed it.
Can you remember who these men were? Who they were?
Well, I can't remember ever Tony Baker associated closely with the DNI senior engineers, for example. Many of them, there were names that I keep on coming across these memories. I mean, that Sergeant Banfield, I had completely forgotten about him until we got down to the Thetford days when my memory was jogged and we shared this two-bedroomed house and the upstairs bathroom. And suddenly, Sergeant Banfield came to life again. I hadn't really thought about him for years. But he was one who didn't wear battle dress. He wore the old tunic uniform, it was the old pre-war, shall I say, crafty, dodging, lying type. You always got those, you know. And he was one of those. He was, I'm glad it was an actual thing. You would trust that man.
But yet he managed to make sergeant, so...
He was already a sergeant, through a long, long service, you see.
And how old was he then at this point?
He must have been in his early 40s at the time. And, you know, to me as a youngster, when I was about 20, 21, he was an old man. But on the other hand, of course, he was well built and he was an old pre-war sweat. But he was also a crafty bugger, you know. You knew that if anybody could get out of anything, it would be him. You know what I mean?
Now, with some of the Beds and Hearts men would have their own clique in the
regiment. Their own clique and company. That's right. And they still spoke Indian to each other. All day long they could hear it.
So who were the other ones, the members of this clique, this Beds and Hearts clique?
Well, there was PSM Jagger was one especially. He was Indian Army all the way through, all day and every day, every month. PSM Blood lived India, you know. As all he did was Indian soldiering in India. The place where they were, up in Bangladesh. But anyway, they were the Beds and Hearts, usually just one place up there in Bangladesh somewhere. Dhaka. They were always talking about Dhaka. D-A-C-C-A.
And why did they talk about it?
That's where they were.
But what did they talk about? Was it a good place? Did they enjoy it? Or?
Oh, well, I mean, it's sad for they've been here for so long that, they all had their Indian servants, private soldiers as well. They're not soldiering in India. They didn't do they called them Dolby Wallers. They didn't do their own washing and ironing of their shirts. They had their KD washed by the natives, and they had their slaves. And they were talking about it and other things, especially sexual matters. Good God Almighty.
So were they'd be nostalgic for that era of the soldier?
That would be their life. Mm-hmm. That would be their life. That's why CPS Day was always talking about Dhaka as well. And that's why he went back to the Indian Army. He got a commission leaving the company, leaving the DLI to go to the Indian Army.
Was there there are Durham battalions, so you'd have lots of the men, particularly with, you know, very strong regional accents. And did the Tibetan arts men have a problem with that? Because they understand what the...
What they, the did they did. They were Londoners mainly, because the best class scattered together was London. And most of them, believe it or not, were Londoners. Pierre Champion, George Gates, Tubby Baker, Harry Stern, all Londoners, all these chaps were Londoners, and with a sprinkling of country, Bedfordshire, and Hertfordshire country chaps. Like old Sergeant Brown, you know, he really had the old Borough of Hertfordshire, he did. But you knew who the country ones were by their accent, and you knew the Cockneys were as well. I was Stern Boy 29 and Stern Boy Nicer. And Living London, and his song was always When London Sleeps. He couldn't sing for Toffee. But he used, when he was pissed, he used to sing While London Sleeps.
And how did that go?
With a sort of a tremor. While London sleeps and all the world is sleeping. You know? Oh, dear.
But where would he sing this? This
he was a real sing? Old public house yeller. He couldn't sing for Toffee, but he always sang that.
And you had a story you told me off the tape about a soldier called Baldra. This was in an early time. And
Baldra.
You had a story about him and his accent.
Baldra was a Durham character. He came from Newcastle or Durham or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, he was a gentle giant. He was about 6'2", heavily built, and very witty, but he never smiled. And he would tell a joke, and he'd have a pan face, like, you know. And I'd say, Baldra, what's up, Baldra? I want a gun, yum. That's what he'd say. But he didn't mean it. That's his way of saying he was fed up. I want a gun, yum.
And what was yum?
I want to go home.
That was slang for home.
And of course, we used to laugh because he didn't say it's mine and he didn't really mean it. But he just said, I'm bloody fed up. He said, I want to gun yum. I want to go home. And he was known for that. That was his style. But he was a good soldier.
And was this day company that you knew?
Yes, it was. I've dealt with him. After his name was normal, maybe, you know. I often wondered the origin of that name.
You were saying that the Tibetan arts men would make fun of the Durham accent.
Some of the old senior ones.
Did the Durham men make fun of the Cockneys? Were they doing?
No, I think they all thought it was a good part, really. I remember particularly that some of the real Geordies, you know, would seriously say, I can't find the beards. Where's my beards? And I can't find the glasses, you know, the braces. And I'd say, what the bloody hell are glasses? The glasses, the braces. Well, why didn't you say braces? And the beards, you can't, where's the beards? And things like
what
that.
What was the bit? What was that? What was the bait?
Boots. Did you know that? Boots.
So there would be, sometimes there'd be a communication problem in terms of the use of slang.
Not with me, because I understood it, but they were really broad Geordies. They were real northeast northern Akala, the salt of the earth, and I love but I was never sure. If I didn't understand what they were saying, I mean, to call braces galluses is a philosophy. I don't know what you mean by that. But I was amused. I said, oh, it's another bird that I've learned today.